Imagine you're on your way to the Galapagos Islands and you are constantly reminded of the immense role of Charles Darwin in trying to interpret the natural history of the islands. You look up Darwin's ideas, which became the benchmark of evolutionary theory. We think of the scientist as an icon, but then you ask yourself, what was he like when he set out on his famous trip? Well, he was 23. Now look at your nearest 23-year-old today. Are they thinking about evolutionary theory? Or any other theory? More likely pickup theory. No wonder the ideas needed polish. Benchmarks are mobile. Frank Szanto has thoughts on this idea of constant refinement. He's a mechanical engineer.
During my school days, benchmarking was something naughty boys did with a chisel at the back of the woodwork class. It has since become a management buzzword. You pick one or two market-leading companies and compare your processes with theirs. If you are not operating according to world's best practice, then you hope to pick up a few pointers on how to realign your business. I wonder if we could leverage the techniques of benchmarking to get optimal outcomes in other areas of human endeavour, like scientific theories. In fact, I'm going to try it right now on two theories which revolutionised our understanding of our place in the universe. First, let us consider heliocentric planetary theory. Copernicus had his hypothesis that the Earth and other planets go around the Sun published on his death in 1543. As we now know, he was on the right track. But his problem was that when it came to predicting the motion of planets in the night sky, his model was no better than the existing geocentric theory. This was because he assumed that the planets move in circular orbits. He even tweaked his model with some epicycles of his own to get better correlation. While the theory may have looked neat, and he no doubt had a strong gut feeling that it must be right, the numbers did not fit reality. And as any fool could see, if the Earth moved, you would fall off. Nearly a century later, Galileo was impressed by the elegant simplicity of the heliocentric theory. Circumstantial evidence, such as sunspots and the motion of moons around the planets, convinced him that the Greeks were wrong, and that Copernicus must be right. He also had some understanding of gravity and inertia, which is important in explaining why we do not fall off a moving planet. But his penchant for sarcasm landed him in hot water, and while the evidence convinced him, it was not enough for his critics. It was Johannes Kepler, a contemporary of Galileo, who cracked the problem. Until then, everyone had accepted the Greek idea that being perfect, a heavenly body must move in a circle. Kepler had access to some accurate observations of Mars and concluded its trajectory is slightly elliptical and not a perfect circle. He then proposed a general rule that all planets move in elliptical orbits with the Sun at one focus. To cap it off, he discovered some mathematical rules relating a planet's orbital speed and its distance from the Sun. This was starting to look like a scientific theory. Half a generation later, Isaac Newton was able to draw on Galileo and Kepler's work. He discovered the laws of motion and gravitation, which he expressed in mathematical equations, inventing calculus on the way to working it out. Newton's laws not only fitted the observed facts and explained why the planets should obey Kepler's laws, but could be used to make predictions about future motion. The return of Halley's Comet is a famous example. So there is the benchmark. Even though nobody could fly into space to check the planets really move around the Sun, the mathematical model based on Newton's laws fitted observed reality so well, it was sufficient to prove it beyond all reasonable doubt. Newton's work was rapidly accepted and became the paradigm for science over the following centuries. All physical phenomena could be described by mathematical models. A model makes it possible to predict behaviour, which can be verified by observation. Newton's laws enabled Herschel to map our galaxy, the Milky Way. They are valid for almost everything we encounter in our daily lives, and they're good enough to guide a rocket to Mars. Yet, in spite of Newton's brilliance, we now know his laws have limitations. In the late 19th century, phenomena such as the spectral distribution of blackbody radiation were discovered, which did not agree with the numbers predicted by Newtonian mechanics. When dealing with the very large or the very small, with galaxies or atoms, you need relativity or quantum mechanics. By giving wrong answers, Newton's laws revealed their own limitations. It is not that they are wrong, but they are a special case of a more general theory. And now we turn to the next revolutionary hypothesis. In The Origin of Species, Darwin set out a theory of evolution challenging the idea that species are immutable. His was not the first evolutionary theory, but earlier great men of biology such as Linnaeus and Cuvier had argued strongly for the fixity of species. In fact, Cuvier was merciless in attacking Lamarck, and not just his theory. Darwin's observations on the Galapagos Islands led him to conclude that species arise from other species. The isolated populations on each island appeared to be unique, and yet clearly showed gradual development from mainland species. Darwin compared what was happening with hybridization, a common function in horticulture, and he decided a similar process occurred in nature, natural selection. Darwin's theory assumed an underlying mechanism which passes on characteristics from one generation to another, and yet allows for changes in these characteristics. As for the mechanism, his theory was light on detail. He had a few ideas, but these were mostly on the wrong track. For example, he dabbled with the idea that environment affects reproduction, that the temperature of seawater might affect the characteristics passed on to creatures reproducing in it. At about the same time, Gregor Mendel developed the gene theory of heredity based on his experiments with peas. Mendel's theory had arithmetical rules. He discovered that when two types are hybridized, the individual offspring are not the average of their parents' characteristics. Instead, as a population, they show a 3-to-1 ratio in expressing the dominant and recessive traits. Mendel's work remained largely unknown until the beginning of the 20th century, by which time Darwin's theory was almost universally accepted, at least in scientific circles. It then became necessary to rework Darwin's evolution in terms of Mendel's genetics. The Neo-Darwinian synthesis was worked out by Fisher, Haldane, and a few others who do not have Australian capital cities named after them. A century after Origin, the structure of DNA was discovered, which gave a physical explanation for how information can be coded and passed on from one generation to the next. This confirmed the gene theory and opened up a whole new field of research. It also provided a possible mathematical explanation for the evolution of new genetic material. Random errors in copying could result in new genes, which would shape their carriers and be passed on to their offspring. But at the same time, there is something of a paradox here. Random errors represent a failure in the reproductive system, which, if it works, is conservative rather than innovative. Generally, selection won't give you something you don't already have. And innovation is a tricky thing. Having some experience in designing and commissioning new things, I'm painfully aware that every time you change something which works, you risk introducing new problems you never thought of. Biological systems are very complex, and it is very easy to foul up a complex system. As an example of what I mean by a complex system, here is an example of mechanical evolution. Engine cooling systems have been around for more than a century. In a typical simple system, engine water is pumped through radiators. Originally, the engine drove the fan, blowing air through the radiator, whether it was needed or not. Then came electrically driven fans, which run when the temperature gets to, say, 85 degrees Celsius, and then stop when the temperature drops to 80. This is controlled by a thermostatic switch, set to turn on and off at these temperatures. In more modern systems, instead of an on-off switch, there is a temperature sensor connected to a programmable controller, which generates a signal to run the fan motors slower or faster according to the temperature. This keeps the engine water closer to the ideal temperature without under or overcooling. But compare this to the complexity of our inbuilt temperature control system. Our skin is also our radiator. When we get hot, more blood flow is directed to the skin. Pores open and water seeps out to cool us by evaporation. Somewhere, probably at many locations, our temperature is being measured and compared to some calibrated reference. Our blood vessels are somehow told to open up, but generally not to the point where we keel over due to loss of flow to our head. And water, not blood, seeps out at a controlled rate. It requires a fair bit of coordination all around. The system works effectively in most environments and even allows people to do crazy things like running marathons in the midday sun. This is an impressive piece of programming, and you know that there must be a program with the equivalent of many lines of code. And that is where it is very hard to grasp how such coding can develop by random iteration. I work in an environment where teams of earnest people beaver away with various computer-assisted design tools, and yet we don't always get it right. In fact, it has been impressed upon me that Murphy's Law is one of the most powerful forces in the universe. Left to their own devices, things have a habit of going wrong because there is so much scope for this to happen. Even though you test things in the lab for all kinds of conditions, out in the real world, you discover things can foul up in ways you never dreamed of. If I were less discreet, I could give many examples of egg on face. Of course, I would never let on about a brand new train which stopped unexpectedly while crossing an iconic structure in a prominent Australian city just before peak hour. It ran out of air, the brakes applied, and it blocked the track for several hours. Many people were very late home that day. Curiously enough, the cause was an energy-saving feature. The auxiliary systems were programmed to shut down if there was no activity in the cab for a period. 40 minutes before, the train had reached its destination, and the driver had moved from the front to the rear cab to return to the city. Due to a dodgy network connection, a signal from the opposite end was ignored, and after counting down, the rear part of the train shut down for the night. This virtual breakdown was easily fixed when the person who knew how arrived and rebooted the system. The software was later modified with an additional input signal so it could not happen again. Job done. But in his wrath, the Minister for Transport swore that the train should never cross the iconic structure again, and so it has been until this very day. The point is that nature is even less forgiving, and it is quite hard to get complex control software right the first time. There are so many conditions which have to be satisfied, and yet the stuff engineers play around with is laughingly simple compared to what goes on in biological systems. We usually get a second chance, but there is no going back to load revised software once something is born or planted. The odds against writing software by random iteration look overwhelming. On the face of it, multiplying a long series of small probabilities produces a very small number indeed, an impossibility, unless you can determine a mathematical model to get around it. And that is the benchmark.
Frank Szanto, a mechanical engineer who usually applies his benchmarks to trains. Next week, Alan Lee from Flinders University in Adelaide, who harks back to Julius Sumner Miller to see what's changed in science education. I'm David Fisher.